is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, cotton prices are on the rise after quite a long time in the doldrums as the natural fibres are tackling synthetics dominance of the market, and timely and sensational rain in the central western Riverina, but parts of the southeast are grappling with drought conditions or near drought conditions.
Drying very quickly, Josh, as it turns out, probably the last 2 or 3 weeks, I think, there's been a pretty dramatic change. Had been remarkably green up until then. Now, browning rapidly, dams dropping, creek almost dry on our place. So things have changed really quite dramatically.
You can always send us a text, of course. 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. Also, we'll hear about bird flu vaccinations, an announcement from the federal government on that. That's coming up shortly as well. But first, the rain over the weekend and yesterday over the Riverina and the Central West has been characterised as sensational and very timely by farmers, graziers and agronomists. Many are calling it a game-changing event after several weeks of warm and dry weather stretching through June and July. Peter Yellen from PY Agronomy and Parks says the crops are now looking good and spring rains will be necessary to bring the crops to full potential, but this rain is very welcome.
Extremely timely, Michael, for the central and southern areas of New South Wales. I think just where I'm based in the Parks area, pretty general 20 to 25 millimetres has fallen in the last 24 hours, with hopefully forecasts for another 7 or 8 mils tomorrow. So absolutely sensational.
Yeah, because pretty dry in the lead up, wasn't it?
Yes, we've had a couple of weeks of genuine winter weather with a lot of, reasonable amount of heavy frost, so that's dried things out a little bit. We hadn't experienced many frosts up until that point this winter. Matter of fact, most people hadn't had a frost until late July, which is really, really unusual.
And super warm in the lead-up, like June, July, I think they were record in terms of temperature for New South Wales.
Yeah, it certainly has been a very warm early part to the winter. Lot of growth, particularly in pasture environments, and also from a crop production point of view, crops have actually, because of that warmth, have been forward in their development. So the weather, the cold weather over the last couple of weeks hasn't been a bad thing, actually, to slow things down a little bit.
What are the risks if they do grow too fast?
Well, maturing early is the issue, and effect from frosting really is the biggest issue. I think as you go in the southern parts of the state, canola particularly is well forward of where it would be traditionally, but around those areas it seems to be has slowed down to be pretty much on time.
Yeah, and maybe the head doesn't feel like it, you'd like it to.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, once you have a frosted head or pod or whatever it is, there's no coming back, basically. So, we do plan. That's why we plant by the calendar to try and reduce the exposure to both frost and heat.
And looking ahead, what would you like to see from now on, like dribs and drabs and then some decent spring rain?
Yes, things will start to warm up now. We're mid-August now, so, we'll start to get reasonable growth now, and then of course in terms of moisture demand or water demand on our crops, they'll start to pull a lot of moisture between now and maturity, so it's critical that regular rainfall that we receive. But at the moment we're pretty much a full profile of moisture heading into the most important time of the year, so it's fantastic. We can't complain.
So a good place to be, but you need the follow-up rain by when? In about 4 weeks time at the latest?
September's always very critical in both cropping and grazing enterprises, just to maximise that growth or fill those positions in the grain growing business. So September's critical, and also preferably if you can organise it for us to have very little heat, would be great too. Thanks.
Although they're still talking about El Nino, aren't they? I mean, it has been warm.
It definitely has been warm, yes, and there still are dry areas in New South Wales for sure. And northern New South Wales is not is not in drought, but I don't think it's abundantly wet either at the same time. So when you say that, you know, regular rainfall is just so critical, but for the next 8 weeks for us.
So another 20 mil, then another 20 mil, that sort of thing, regular bursts of it here and there on the way through.
I think we'll take what we get. I don't think we'll be too complaining on what occurs when.
Don't be too prescriptive, yeah.
You're right regarding the El Nino talk. It's still there, but it depends on who you listen to or what you read as to, you know, how relevant or how much damage that may inflict on us in the next couple of months.
And what about the grazing situation? So dams are full now or not quite, and the pastures would be doing pretty well with that rain?
Depending on your locality, I think as you go west of the Newell, there probably hasn't been as significant as amount of runoff as what you would experience in east of the Newell. But yes, you know, in comparison to where we were in April this year, where we're looking at major water shortages everywhere, it is it a complete different story to, you know, from half capacity to overflowing in some areas in terms of groundwater storage. So it's been a massive turnaround since April.
Yes, talking about the situation there, Peter Yelland of PY Agronomy in Parkes saying their crops are looking good. Those spring rains still necessary. Well, farmers in the southeast say drought conditions have started to take hold with dam levels dropping and creeks drying up. According to the DPIRD, 35% of the Yirrabadalla is classified as in drought and 65% drought affected. A warm winter and a prediction of warm spring has farmers concerned about the prospect of bushfires as well. Peter Atkinson is a small beef cattle operation south of Maruya. He says conditions have rapidly deteriorated.
Drying very quickly, Josh, as it turns out. Probably the last 2 or 3 weeks, I think, there's been a pretty dramatic change. Had been remarkably green up until then. Now, browning rapidly, dams dropping, creek almost dry on our place. So things have changed really quite dramatically.
How long's it been since you've had, I guess, a decent dose of rain?
Well, I'm just looking at the rain chart. In June, we had 9 mils only. In July, we only had 2.5 here. And so far this month, we had 3 mils last night. So we've had 3.5 mils so far in August. But compared to last year, tremendous difference. Last year in July, we had 184 mils. Last August, we had 104 mils. June was dry. It was only 4. But then in May, we had 111, Josh. So tremendous difference between the 2 years. Yep.
When you look at the EDIS map from the Department of Primary Industries, it says Yirrabadalla is about 65% drought affected and 35% are in the drought category in terms of the different parts of the southeast. What's the water situation like at the moment? You mentioned dams are starting to decline.
Oh, well, the dams around us, including our own, of course, they're dropping quite quickly. And our creek, which had been flowing slowly, say 10 days ago, has pretty much stopped now. Water in the holes, of course, but pretty much it's stopped flowing. If you dig a hole somewhere, certainly on the hills, there's not much moisture to be found in the soil down quite a way. It really has changed.
How are you feeling about the outlook for spring as there's a forecast of drier and warmer conditions on the way?
Josh, I tend to be a pretty optimistic sort of person, but I'm afraid I'm a little bit pessimistic about the what's coming in the next few months, to be quite honest. I hear people on the Country Hour, there's not a lot of faith in Bureau forecasting, but no, I'm not very optimistic at all, I have to say.
Well, they did forecast a warmer winter and it's been exactly that. It's been incredibly mild for a large portion of it, and then we've got some cracker frosts in recent times, like we do in August often, but that's cured out the pastures and stripped out more of the moisture as well.
It has, and to be quite honest, in this case, with the forecast El Nino, hotter, drier, and I'm tending to believe that that is what's going to happen.
There's already been people, I guess, preparing their properties, doing some pile burns, and as it's been dry, some pile burns have got away. It's been a long time since there's been significant fires in the Irrabaddala region since Black Summer. Are you concerned about the bushfire outlook as the conditions are starting to get drier?
Yes, yes, I am, because my wife and I ride up in the bush every weekend, up straight up behind our place, up into the forests and private land, and then there's forestry and national park. And each week we see a marked deterioration, especially on the ridges. Down in the gullies, it's still quite moist, some water in some of the gullies, not all of them, but on the ridges, drying out rapidly. And there were some small burns done earlier in the year, not terribly significant in our area. We were up in the yesterday, and a marked change even over the last couple of weeks.
Yes, talking about the drought conditions in the Irrabaddala, 65% of drought affected and 35% in drought. And that was Peter Atkinson, who runs cattle south of Maria, talking there to Josh Becker.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
The federal government will start rolling out vaccinations against bird flu for priority species in the coming days. At an announcement in Canberra today, ministers and experts said states will decide which species are prioritised, but zoos will likely be the place a vaccination program starts. Agriculture Minister Julie Collins, Environment Minister Murray Watt and Chief Vet Dr. Beth Cookson have been speaking to the media just a short time ago.
We have been very clear that this will continue to spread across the country. We also know that as the disease becomes more widespread in wildlife, counting individual confirmed birds no longer gives us the clearest picture of how this disease is spreading. So our reporting will evolve to focus on confirmed H5 events and the developments that matter most. I'll now hand to Minister Watt.
Today's announcement is another step in supporting our bird population to face up to the massive challenge of bird flu. As the Environment Minister, I very much welcome this development and this announcement by Minister Collins to roll out targeted vaccinations of priority native species. As we've heard, Australia has been doing vaccination trials for some period of time, and now we're making a commitment to roll out those vaccinations more broadly, with the federal government supporting states and territories to vaccinate priority species that they identify based on expert advice. It is difficult to vaccinate birds in the wild. It does take two vaccination doses to vaccinate birds, and it is difficult enough to catch wild birds once, let alone twice. Where it's possible to vaccinate wild birds, we will do so, but the priority here is to vaccinate birds that are in captivity, and of course in our zoos and various other institutions, we've been taking steps to ensure that we do have populations of our most vulnerable bird species, and they're going to be the priority when it comes to vaccinations. We're taking this step now because, of course, the situation regarding bird flu in Australia is escalating. We're taking a graduated response to step up that response as developments unfold based on expert advice.
What are some of the species that we can expect to see vaccinated, and how many species will you be targeting straight up?
So that obviously depends on the work that the states and territories are doing in relation, as I said, to captive native species, but also whether or not the vaccines are effective in that species, but also it's obviously part of the response. For some threatened species, the response might not include vaccines. It might be much more about biosecurity. It might be much more about resilience of that species. But I'll hand to Dr. Cookson to answer the details of that question.
The trials and pilots that we've undertaken so far has provided us some safety data across a range of different species. And there's now active consideration being taken with our state and territory colleagues who are guiding the prioritisation of those species and the identification of the populations that can appropriately be vaccinated.
So you can't say where you would start or which species or which geographic locations or facilities?
So the states and territories will be making their own announcements in coming days in relation to starting the vaccinations and what they've identified as their priority species. So we've been working very closely with them. I'm not going to make that announcement on their behalf.
That's Agriculture Minister Julie Collins. We also heard from Chief Vet Dr. Beth Cookson and Environment Minister Murray Watt at a press conference a short time ago. Well, egg producers are on high alert after the New South Wales government confirmed the state's first cases of H5 avian influenza in Australian native birds. The government says one bird was found dead near Naruma on the south coast, the other near Wentworth in western New South Wales. And while bird flu is yet to hit the poultry sector, reporter Emily Middleton caught up with egg producer James Ryan, who has 900 free-range chickens on his farm at Mullion Creek.
Yeah, obviously it's a bit of a worry, or not just a bit of a worry, it is a worry. New cases popping up, so it's definitely about, I suppose, our attitude is that with it is we can only control what we can. Yeah, it's pretty hard to stop wild birds from flying around where they want. You know, there's not much we can sort of do about that.
What are you doing then, I suppose, to sort of try and protect yourselves?
Yeah, we're trying to, you know, not entice wild birds to sort of come near our flock. So just little things like we don't have any open water sources near the hens, so they all get their water from nipple drinkers along the side of our chicken caravans. All our feed, we don't like throw feed out on the ground. We've got them all in closing feeders that the chickens get access to, that are got like a cover over the top, so wild birds don't like going in underneath there because they can't fly straight up. Yeah, so they're just some little things that we do to deter wild birds. And then we're obviously, restricting visitors and stuff coming to the farm at the moment.
I've heard of a number of farms around the region who have decided to sort of go into lockdown and despite having a free-range farm. Is this something you've looked at doing?
Yeah, I suppose for us it's just not really possible. Like, we just don't have the finances to, we don't have like any infrastructure out there to house 900 chickens. I sort of get the idea behind it, but yeah, for us financially, so it's not really possible to go build a big shed to house 900 birds in. And yeah, then we're not free range anymore. You know, they're not out on the grass, in the pasture, you know, sort of living their best life.
When it comes into, I suppose, as bird flu continues to spread and the fact that there has been a few more cases that have come up, what kind of support have you received so far? Is it enough for what you are needing to do?
Yeah, I haven't received any support from the government. I mean, the DPI sent out like a newsletter sort of at the start of it, or an email, sorry, recommending that you house your birds. But other than that, yeah, that's it so far.
I guess, is there anything else that you can do to try and make sure that you are supportive for when it may eventually come closer to Mullion Creek?
Like, they've got hotlines and stuff as well. So if we start seeing some cases getting closer to us, then, yeah, I'll sort of cross that bridge when I get to it, as far as, you know, contacting the relevant authorities and sort of, yeah, see what it all entails from there. But yeah, at the moment, I suppose we're just sort of staying vigilant, checking all our hands for any signs that any could be affected or anything like that, keeping tabs on sort of where it's spreading at the moment.
What would you like to see happen going forward now that these cases are spreading?
I suppose some sort of plan of whether there's going to be, people that do get affected, what that looks like for them. Because, yeah, if we start getting a lot of farms affected, obviously eggs are going to have a shortage of eggs again. We need people producing eggs in Australia. So, yeah, I guess what the plan is, like there was talks of like vaccines and stuff like that. Yeah, I haven't heard much about that recently, but whether that's something they can fast track to have available for farmers, or yeah, if farms do get affected, is there any sort of funding to help them get back and running again?
That was egg producer James Ryan talking there to Emily Middleton. You're listening to The Country Hour, 24 minutes past 12.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Well, after a couple of flat years, cotton prices have been rising in 2026 and are currently sitting at about $620 per bale. So what's causing the rise and how is the industry going in terms of winning back market share from synthetic fibres such as polyester? Mark Brand spoke to Joan Nicosia, who's the global head of cotton for Louis Dreyfus Company.
Well, thanks, Matt. You know, the cotton market is, I'd say, in a state of flux right now. There's a great deal of uncertainty that exists in the world, not only because of the growing conditions we have in the Northern Hemisphere, but maybe even more importantly from policy and politics. You know, when we look at the problems in the Middle East, there's really been two things that it's caused to the cotton market in and of itself. One is the volatility has increased. You know, day to day, the situation is changing all the time. But more directly, what we're really seeing is that for the first time, it's affected polyester availability and prices. Traditionally, as crude prices have moved up, it hasn't always translated into an increase in polyester prices. But what we saw this year was really more of a fear of supply, more so than price, on the polyester side. So we did see for a period of time textile mills, mostly in Asia, increasing the percentage of cotton that they were running versus polyester. And we're hopeful that that trend will continue as we move forward, if the products that they're making will help promote cotton consumption.
And what do you think the key is for cotton to keep getting more market share over the synthetics?
You know, Matt, you asked the question about polyester man-made fiber versus cotton, and what do we need or what do we do in order to try to promote more use and more demand for cotton? This is probably the most critical question that we're facing as an industry today. You know, I was really hopeful, and what I'm going to try to talk a little bit through here at the Australian conference is what Australia can do to help promote cotton consumption. The United States is really taking the first step forward in this through many different initiatives that exist. There's been a greater focus all the way through now. There's the promotional program of We're Plant, Not Plastic, which has been quite successful coming out of the United States. We're going to try to broaden that approach to highlight the virtues and the value creation of natural fibers. But there's more than that. You know, in the United States, most people here that I've talked to don't even understand or haven't even heard of the STOMP initiative, which was the systematic targeting of microplastics. I encourage the audience, you know, go ahead and Google microplastics and health and see what you'll see. You know, they're finding microplastics throughout our bodies, throughout our brains, through reproductive organs. And Australia needs to try to reposition itself that cotton is a solution. You know, it's an answer to some of these problems that exist to where things are. So I think we're at the beginning, and I'm hopeful that I think we're going to start to make some real inroads into awareness of that. But I'm also realistic to realize that, you know, we're going to make a lot more impact, whether it be through legislation or regulation, than necessarily consumer awareness one at a time. But we're going to take both avenues and pursue that, because that's really the end game for cotton, is to differentiate itself from man-made fiber to natural fibers.
Meanwhile, for those growing this crop, when it comes to prices, what are you expecting over the next sort of 12 to 24 months?
Well, you know, prices have already moved up over these last several months, you know, and I described what I think happened is volatility was very low. Prices were low for, I don't know, 18 months or so. And the marketplace was really pricing what I would say was the present conditions. We know Brazil has had very large crops. They've been trying to push those supplies into the marketplace. And Australia, United States, other exporters have had to compete. So that has limited the ability for prices to really rally. But somewhere a couple of months ago, the marketplace started to focus on different things, on the possibility of the United States and China having a trade deal, promoting agricultural products. Hopeful cotton would be one of those. We had the possibility of the Buy American Cotton Act to help promote the use of U.S. cotton that will be through there. We have now the reciprocal trade from the 301 tariffs for textile reciprocal trade. I mentioned earlier about the STOMP initiative. And the market now is starting to price the future. You know, early indications are for a deficit going into the 27 crop year. We're not really there today. Today there's sufficient cotton that's around as we're finishing up the 26 campaign that's there. But we'll see how that manifests going forward. You know, it would be great if we could end a couple of wars, if we could get people a little bit more engaged in whatever normalcy is in today's world or whatever that might look like. But I'm hopeful that we've turned the corner on consumption because, you know, cotton has continued over the years to lose percentage share to man-made fiber. And that's really the fight that we're facing here. You know, too much time, I think, in our industry, we're competing against one another, Australia against U.S., against Brazil. But we really need to get together, come together, and realize that if we can grow the pie, grow world demand, you know, make the case for the values of natural fibers, that's where we all can win.
That's Joe Nicosia, who's the global head of cotton for Louis Dreyfus, and he was one of the keynote speakers at the Australian Cotton Conference being held on the Gold Coast. It's 12:30 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Shortly we'll have some weather details. It's drying out a bit. A high weather pattern is coming in over the state. We'll hear more about that shortly. But before we do anything else, let's get some news headlines from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The Federal Opposition says it's yet to settle on its position on Labor's proposed gambling laws. This was despite the Prime Minister suggesting yesterday afternoon that the two parties were on the brink of a deal, and he hoped to have the legislation into the Parliament by later in the week. Angus Taylor and Anthony Albanese are in direct talks on the matter, but the Coalition Party Room was told there's been no agreement yet, and five Coalition MPs in the meeting spoke in favour of taking even tougher action on gambling, while four others warned against over-regulation. The Trade Minister says he's spoken to his US counterpart for the first time since the Trump administration. Put higher tariffs on Australian goods. The US announced late last month it would be lifting the tariff on exports from 10 to 12%. Senator Farrell says he reiterated Australia's position in his phone call with Jamieson Greer, which the minister described as a constructive discussion. It's census night. Have you done your census yet, Michael?
No, it's tonight.
No, it's tonight.
Have to wait.
If you knew where you're going to be tonight, you could have done it earlier, apparently.
Oh, yeah. Is that right?
I didn't read the fine print. And you never know where you're going to be.
Never know where I'm going to be.
On a Tuesday night.
I'm everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the federal government says it's confident everything possible has been done to protect the census. This was after the Bureau of Statistics was forced to shut down the census website in 2016 when it was targeted four times by hackers.
Let's hope that doesn't happen again.
Let's hope that doesn't happen again.
I bet they hope that doesn't happen again as well.
Yes. And on top of that, it's interest rate decision today. So 2:30, we'll find out whether rates go up or stay on hold. Majority out of economists, almost 90% or more, are predicting that they will stay on hold.
Yes, they are. That's quite right.
Yes. Prove me wrong.
No, I think they'll be right. 90%.
Yeah.
It'll be on hold for a bit. But you never know. It could rise again later in the year.
Yes.
Or early next year.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to wait and see what happens to inflation. There you go. That's my tip.
I have nothing more to say.
And we'll be listening at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
It's 27 minutes to 1 on the Country Hour. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. Juan Park is there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Marco.
So has all the rain moved through now?
Yes, much of the rain has moved through, although we may see some lingering showers on and west of the ranges today, but probably nothing much because the front that has brought the weekends into Monday's rain event has moved well offshore. But the winds are still fresh and gusty over the ranges, and some, as I said, some light showers may still be lingering, but probably not much rainfall out of this. And the maximum temperatures will be about single digits to low teens on the ranges, tending low to mid teens in about the southern inland and high teens in the north, and high teens to low 20s along the coast. But because of these fresh westerly winds, the wind chill factors may make you feel the temperatures a bit colder than the actual temperatures. And we expect a similar weather with fresh and gusty westerly winds to prevail tomorrow with some showers on the ranges and the western slopes and the adjacent inland plains for tomorrow as well. As the next cold front moves across the state between, say, Wednesday to early Thursday. So with this system, some thunderstorms may be possible about the southern and central inland and the western slopes as the system moves through. And Don't expect much rainfall out of this because, we generally expect just a few millimeters of passing showers with this system. Much of the state nevertheless will receive, at least, millimeter or two of rainfall with this. And then also, but on the other hand, these showers may be falling as snow on the Alpine and the ACT ranges above 1,200 meters. And, on the Alpine peaks, there could be something like 5 to 20 centimeters of snow. And also, there is a non-zero chance of snow flurries on the higher parts of the central tablelands, like Oberon, and extending to Barrington tops. But this will remain a watch point. Then, but as I said, overall rainfall will be fairly little, because this system is not drawing much moisture and also fast moving. And once this system moves through, we will be under the influence of a high pressure system moving over South Australia during the later part of the week. That means the dry and the stable weather patterns will be returning to much of the western districts from Thursday or Friday into the weekend. But on the other hand, this high-pressure system will be bringing onshore south to southeasterly airstream along the coast as it heads towards Tasmania. That means the showers may be developing along the coast during the weekend.
Right, okay, so showers, and we're talking showers, aren't we? Only a few millimetres here, and they're not talking about a similar sort of, 20 to 40 millimetres or anything like that for the state for the next few days.
That's right, yes. So we are not really looking into any significant rainfall for the next 7 days.
And the high pressure system would be the main feature then. How long will that last?
This high pressure system will be drifting into, Tasman Sea by Monday, but at least up until Sunday, we are not really looking into any precipitation, although maybe states far west, far western end of upper or in the lower western, and places like Broken Hill may see some developing showers or possibly thunderstorms maybe early next week with the inland trough system. But on the other hand, the showery conditions will be persisting along the coast, and the rest of the state looks set to remain dry at least early next week.
Okay, so we're looking at a fairly dry for 4, 5, 6 days?
That's right, yes. But nevertheless, tomorrow, you're
might be a shower here and there.
Yes, yeah, that's right, yes.
And any other sort of major fronts coming on the horizon on the computer models?
I've been only looking at the weather pattern for the next 7 days.
Okay.
So I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I just thought I'd ask. Put it out there. That's okay. No worries. All right, Juan, thanks for that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's 22 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, Australia's dairy industry is facing a bit of a reckoning over concerns that cow's milk has played a role in the deaths of three toddlers in Queensland. Dr. Sally Campbell is a blood specialist at the Queensland Children's Hospital who says the toddlers died after drinking too much milk and appears to have exacerbated anaemia in those cases. Dr. Campbell wants health professionals and the dairy industry to change their message when it comes to young children and milk.
Children less than 5 should have a maximum of 500 mils of cow's milk per day. And the reason for that is that whilst cow's milk does have nutritious substances within it, more than that can stop them eating food, absorbing iron, and can lead to severe and extreme iron deficiency anemia. There have been 3 toddlers who have died in Queensland in the last 2 years, and their deaths were contributed to an excess of cow's milk. That is, they were drinking more than 1 litre of cow's milk per day. And sadly, this resulted in them developing extreme iron deficiency anemia and sadly dying. Now, I don't want to alarm families with this because I know out there, people listening, there will be a large number of families who are drinking more, whose children are drinking more than 500 mils per day. And this is not their fault. I think the messaging about this has not been good. I think we need better health messaging about cow's milk and children. And that is today, that is that 500 ml max. 2 cups per day, very safe for children.
Dr. Sally Campbell is a blood specialist at the Queensland Children's Hospital, and already the dairy industry is worried about what this could mean for the perception of dairy in Australia, especially for those who rely on cow's milk as their primary source of income. Ben Bennett is a Southwest Victorian dairy farmer and president of Australian Dairy Farmers. He says the situation is tragic, but it needs a bit more nuance.
Absolutely tragic, eh? Like, you know, like most dairy farmers, we're all family people, and, you know, that is very concerning. But I suppose, you know, like I saw the article over the weekend, and it definitely grabbed my attention. But, you know, I think we need to look further into the article, and, you know, it sort of it does have further complications to what these poor little kids had. And I don't think the article, the headline really reflects the body of the article, even though you do have to read quite a bit into it.
Ben Bennett, he's the president of the Australian Dairy Farmers, representing farmers across the country. What do you believe the perception could mean for the dairy industry in the country?
Oh, look, people have been drinking milk for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and, you know, it is very, very concerning. Like, you know, I am a farmer, you know, I milk cows myself. I'm not saying I'm a nutritionist or anything, and I leave that to the experts, and, you know, all dairy farmers pay a levy to contribute to our expert people, which is Dairy Australia, and I think they could produce a more informed perspective of the situation.
What do you think the impact could potentially be on dairy farmers, particularly if people start buying less milk?
Oh, yeah, I think the general public sort of, you know, are sort of aware of headlines and upon that headline. But I think the story needs to be noted that there sadly was more complications to those terrible incidences that did happen.
President of the Australian Dairy Farmers, Ben Bennett, speaking there with Crispian Yeomans. It's coming up to 18 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today with rates widely expected to stay on hold today as the RBA meets. The search continues for survivors after a very strong earthquake in Colombia collapses buildings and kills more than 100 people. And of course, it's census time tonight. Are we losing our religion? The no religion option is a small design choice with a surprisingly long and at times politically loaded history. Find out more on The World Today.
Here on The Country, our recent reports of worker exploitation in the horticulture industry have renewed calls for the introduction of a labour hire licensing scheme in New South Wales. It was a key recommendation to come out of a New South Wales parliamentary report into modern slavery, which was handed down last week and has been backed by peak industry bodies. But what would a labour hire licensing scheme actually look like on the ground? University of Sydney Professor of Work and Labour Market Policy Chris Wright told Lauren Bohane how a licensing scheme would help stop dodgy labour operations from slipping through the cracks in regulation.
They exist in a bit of a loophole around the different laws that exist for protecting workers and ensuring that businesses are complying with their responsibilities. So a labour hire licensing scheme would basically provide labour hire companies with various obligations around ensuring that they are complying with workplace laws and a range of other laws around migration, around taxation, superannuation, these types of things, in order to operate. Labour hire companies under such a scheme would be registered publicly, and if they were not compliant with their laws and didn't have a record of that, then they wouldn't be allowed to be listed on that register. And it's a way of making sure that there's greater accountability amongst labour hire companies themselves and ensure that they are compliant, to also provide greater assurance for the businesses who are engaging them. and also providing greater transparency and accountability. And these sorts of schemes operate in other jurisdictions like Queensland, like Victoria, like the ACT, but not in New South Wales and not in other states. Labour hire companies allow businesses to engage workers when they need them, but our employment laws don't really account for them very well at all.
Right. Now, you mentioned that other states do have labour hire licensing schemes in place. I know Queensland, for example, that's fairly recent. What sort of impact has that had on, you know, cracking down on I guess, those dodgy operators in this space?
Yeah, there have been some studies and inquiries into the schemes that exist in various states, and they've found that these schemes can improve transparency by ensuring that the labour hire operators who are licensed are compliant. It can allow the businesses who are looking to engage workers via a labour hire licensing arrangement to know that they're engaging a business that is compliant. This can also take out the capacity for businesses to compete or to function effectively by undercutting or non-complying with employment laws and other laws. And it can complement some of the other systems that we have in place in Australia around our Fair Work system for ensuring that laws are being enforced properly. So it's a way of providing greater transparency and accountability, and can help with the effort to ensure workers are protected. But I don't think it's a complete panacea for systems that are necessary to ensure that workers are being protected. And that's one of the key issues that's led to a lot of focus on this, on labour hire licensing as an idea, because we've had some absolutely devastating cases over a very long period of time of workers being mistreated, being underpaid, being injured and killed because of labour hire arrangements that are not fit for purpose.
One concern that those in the industry have raised around labour hire operators is that when investigators turn up, the companies pack up and disappear, essentially, only then to Phoenix under a new business name and doing those same dodgy operations. Would a licensing scheme address that? I know you mentioned accountability a couple of times. Is that something that this would address?
It might. Hopefully it would help to improve, but we also need stronger enforcement powers by under Fair Work Ombudsman, by other actors like unions, to ensure that when companies do Phoenix, that this is being picked up and those people behind these arrangements are being held accountable. Phoenixing is a huge problem, and the measures that exist to address it currently are not satisfactory.
University of Sydney Professor of Work and Labour Market Policy, Chris Wright, speaking there to Lauren Bohane. Joe's texted in from Grafton to say if the government had 1 ounce of integrity, they'd have social media sites advertising Australia's minimum wage and contact details for employer breaches. Instead, they introduce another useless superficial shopfront, giving employees false hopes. Employers won't actually be involved in taking money or working against backpacker farm workers or overseas immigrants as well. And someone's texted in, John has texted in from Bega to say calcium and iron problems may have more to do with anti-red meat and pro-vegetarian and vegan proponents than a milk problem, according to John, who is a biochemist at Bega. And Cheryl is pretty sceptical about excess milk consumption causing these three deaths as well, saying there needs to be more research that these kids might have had some sort of allergy or some other medical issues. I think they might have had some other medical issues as well. And on the rain, we're getting some texts in from Dave in Trundle, who says the grand total of 18 millimetres of rain over the 2 days wasn't really enough. He needs follow-up rains of at least 40 to 50 millimetres required for his property there. It's coming up to 11 minutes to one.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, of all the titles decided at the Mount Isa Rodeo, the open bull ride kept the crowds waiting until the very end. The last cowboy to climb into the chutes in northwest Queensland was 18-year-old Brodie Meredith from Armidale in New South Wales. It was his first time competing at Mount Isa, and what a debut it turned out to be. Brodie finished the weekend at 171 points, enough to walk away with the 2026 Open Bull Ride Championship. Andrew Saunders was waiting behind the chutes to have a chat to him.
G'day, I'm Brodie Meredith. I just won the Open Bull Ride at Mount Isa.
So what's going through your mind?
Heaps. It's too much to really talk about, I suppose. Good to get something done up here.
Atmosphere here today, you were the last rider out. What was going through your mind before that ride?
Just make it count, I suppose. Just do something. I come in a pretty good spot and just thought I just need to ride a good one. And a couple of the boys made pretty good bull rides before me, so I thought I'll have to just really have a go.
Tell us a bit about yourself, how long you've been riding and all that.
About 10 years when I started. I was 8 years old. I'm 18 now, so 10 years. And
only 18?
Yeah, yeah.
Besides bull riding, what else do you do?
I'm like a boiler maker by trade. I'm doing my apprenticeship at the minute in Armidale. I'm about 2 years into that. Otherwise, just rodeo, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and how did you get into the rodeo riding?
No, really. Easy way to put it, I suppose. I just sort of was sitting at home and me and Dad were just fiddling around, I guess, with a few cows and that, and I thought I'll give it a go. And had a couple of family friends that sort of pushed me on a little bit to get it all started, and then, yeah, Mum and Dad just kept pushing me on, and my mates and that all just kept supporting me. So,
was it always bulls all that time ago, or did you ride other stock?
Before I started riding bulls, and even when I first started riding bulls, I rode horses, like not barking horses, just rode horses around, you know, a bit of camp draft and whatnot, but I only ever rode bulls in the rodeo. So,
as a junior, did you have much success?
Yeah, I'd say I went not too bad. I won't talk about myself too much, but yeah. No.
Tell us a bit about it.
I won a couple of averages at the ABSRA National Finals and went pretty well. I had a heap of success in every weekend.
How hard was that going from a junior rider to the senior riders like here in Mount Isa?
Yes, it was a bit, but I sort of, before I started stepping up onto them bit bigger bulls, I sort of tried getting on a few bit bigger ones in the practice pen just to get a bit used to it and whatnot, and did make it. I think it would have probably made it a little bit easier for me, but it is still, it's always going to be a big jump, I suppose, yeah.
And Mount Isa, this is your first time here. What's it been like, besides winning?
Yeah, it's been good. It's hot, very hot, but compared to Armidale, it's been cold there lately. But yeah, I come up here and a bit of fun with my mates, hanging around here for a couple of days, and good rodeo.
Yeah, where does it rank? You've done a lot of rodeos in junior and senior now. Where does it rank?
This is probably one of the bigger ones, I'll definitely say, one of the bigger turnouts I've been to. I'd say this probably outdoes a lot of them.
And the atmosphere, what's it like?
Yeah, it's good. It's very good. It's a fairly decent crowd there today, and last night when I rode my first bull, it was a massive crowd. It's pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, last night was a full house. Take us through that. What was it like?
I made another pretty good bull ride, and it was good. I jumped off, and everything was loud, and all my mates on the back of the chutes.
And what's ahead for you?
I'm not too sure yet.
Would you like to go to the States?
Yeah, I've got plans too. I'd like to try and finish my apprenticeship first, and then I'd like to go over when I finish that and see what sort of luck I can have over there. But I'd definitely like to go over eventually, yeah.
It's tough going being a bull rider, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tough. And trying to work a job too.
You're only 18. How are you going to celebrate?
I'm driving home tonight, so it won't be a lot of celebrating tonight, I don't think. But I'm sure when I get home, I might have a few beers or something.
And Mount Isa Rodeo, will you be back next year to defend your title?
I'll give it a go, yeah.
18-year-old Brodie Meredith from Armidale, the champion of the 2026 Mount Isa Rodeo Open Bull Ride. Let's go to markets. First up, Wodonga cattle.
Good afternoon. Wet weather meant numbers almost halved to 630, with half the yarding made up of cows. Not all the winter buyers are at the sale this week. However, those that did attend were all keen for a market share. Quality was fair to very good. There was a reduced selection of veal and quality was excellent. Prices lifted 14 to 15 cents, selling at 440 to 550. Trade steers are unchanged, 490 to 534. Feeder steers, too few to quote, 455 to 518. Feeder heifers, heifers were back 50 cents, $4 to $4.75 for the medium weights. Trade heifers fell 30 cents, $4.02 to $4.96. Heavy steers to suit processors, though, jumped 31 cents, $4.22 to $5.44. Bullocks were back 30, $4.20 to $4.45. Heavy heifers, $4.10 to $4.70. Holding firm, heavy cows eased 5 cents, $3.95 to $4.38. Leaner cows were very few, $3.20 to $3.62. Heavy bulls, $4.05 to $4.30. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
To Forbes Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers fell this sale with agents yarding 35,900 head. Lamb numbers increased to 29,000 and quality was fair. There was a good offering of grain-assisted finished trade and export lambs available, along with the planer and secondary lines. The usual buyers were present competing in a firmed Tadira market. It was 3,900 new season lambs panned and seat. These sold from $280 to $325 a head. Old trade weight lambs affirmed $4 better, with prices ranging from $247 to $312 a head. Heavy lambs, 24 to 26 kilos, held steady to sell from $298 to $323, while the export lambs were firmed $4 better, with prices ranging from $318 to a top of $404. Carcass prices averaged from $1,054 to $1,257 a kilo. The best heavy hogget reached $300 a head. The balance of the lambs and 6,900 head of mutton are still to be sold. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
To Carcor Cattle.
Good afternoon. Substantial rainfall in the supply area dropped numbers to 1,027. It was a good run of young cattle, but the grown steers and heifers were limited. The cow run was also plainer. Yearlings and the lighter grown steers and heifers to feed were dearer, the coloured cattle having some of the bigger gains. The few prime grown steers and heifers were firmed to slightly dearer, but the cow run sold to a cheaper trend. Feeder steers averaged 30 cents dearer, $4.90 to $5.75. The feeder heifers jumped 30 to 35 cents with medium and heavy weights, $4.80 to $5.51. The heavy trade cattle sold from $4.72 to $5.20. Prime grown steers and bullocks remained firm, $4.40 to $4.95. Heavy grown heifers were dearer and they reached $4.52. The best of the heavy cows remained firm, $3.98 to $4.18. The planer and lighter cows dropped 14 cents with no restocking orders in place. And the two-score cow sold from $3.45 to $3.68.
To Gunnedah Cattle.
1,550 cattle were scanned in Gunnedah, 730 less than last sale. It was a mixed quality yarding. All major buyers were in attendance in a market that saw the few prime heavier weight cattle offered improve, while most other grades were cheaper. Prime yearling cattle to the trade made to 455 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers to feed lacked quality and were over 25 cents cheaper to make from 482 to 585 cents a kilogram. Yearling heifers to feed under 400 kilograms improved in quality to make from 492 to 532 cents, while the heifers over 400 kilograms were considerably cheaper to make from 435 to 526 cents a kilogram and averaged 490 cents. Load steers of the restocker were 20 cents cheaper to make from 462 to 559 cents. Some better lines of restocker heifers saw the top end of that category improve to make from 340 to 524 cents a kilogram. Prime grown cattle to the processor made to 468 cents. Two and three score cows were 15 cents cheaper. Two score cows made from 348 to 364 cents. Three score cows made from 358 to 370 cents. Prime heavyweight cows held firm to make from 380 to 412 cents. And the best bulls got to 390 cents a kilo. This is Hamish Hosegood in Gunnedah for MLA.
To Inverell Cattle.
Inverell penned another winter offering with 467 mixed cattle, a reduction of over half from last sale. Trends varied with better bred young cattle selling to dearer trends, a lack of quality through some plainer categories resulting in cheaper trends. A lack in cow weight and quality saw cows sell to cheaper trends throughout. Regular buyers attended. Weaner steers under 200 kilos to 6 better, 400 to 568. Heifers lifted 8, 320 to 352. Light yearling steers to background cheaper, 400 to 464. Similar feeders to 16 dearer, 488 to 565. Medium feeders gained 24, 426 to 560. Light heifers to background lost 21, 418 to 436. A line of heavy feeders making to 38 better, selling to 530. Grown heifers to process down 6, 366 to 372. Medium processing cows 16 cheaper, 230 to 352. Heavy cows down slightly, 350 to 389. Heavy bulls firm, 380 to 408. Stephen Adams, MLA at Inverell.
And to Scone Cattle.
Good afternoon. Light rainfall totals in the drawing area saw Scone agents yard 517 cattle, 250 head less than last week. Quality was good in the weaner calves, which saw the market reverse the previous week's cheaper trends to show mostly positive sentiments. The yearlings presented were of a mixed nature. Light steer calves, 24 cents a kilo dearer, selling between 356 and 568 cents a kilo, and they averaged around 533 cents. Light heifer calves, 9 cents a kilo better off, 340 to 536, and they averaged around 460. Yearling steers to feed on all cheaper, medium weights 428 to 554, heavyweights over 400 kilos, 480 to 506. Most of the yearling heifers show cheaper trends, with medium and heavyweights to the lot feeders trading from 430 to 510, with B-muscles to the local butchers making up to 528. 20% of the yarding were cows and mostly in good buckle. Lighter cows with cover, 13 cents a kilo dearer, 304 to 386. Heavy prime 3 and 4 scores firmed to slightly dearer and sold between 354 and 398 cents a kilo. Angus Barlow for MLA at Scone.
You've been listening to The Country Hour, broadcasting tomorrow from Orange, from the Renewables in Ag Conference. So join us then between 12 and 1. It's news time.